Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You're listening to WCOM LP 103.5 FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. It's a Tuesday, it's 5 o'clock, and that only means one thing. It's time for another round of Snarky Faith with your host, Stuart Deloney. This is a space where we irreverently wrestle through life, culture and spirituality, all with our heads in the clouds, our tongues in our cheeks, our hearts in our sleeves, and our feet on the ground. At Snarky Faith, the questions or even the answers are never the point. It's all about the conversation. So here's your host, Stuart Deloney.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to another round of Snarky Faith. I'm your host, Stuart Deloney, and Snarky Faith is radio for the spiritually disenfranchised. If you've had enough of the insanity in Christianity, you've come to the right place. Here at Snarky Faith, we're all about finding a sane faith grounded in reality and working to make the world a better place in tangible ways. We're here to call out religious BS, look for better ways forward, and help you realize that you're not crazy. This religious stuff is completely messed up. And if you can handle your conversations about faith with copious amounts of
sarcasm
and also a bit of this, then welcome home. We're glad you're here. On today's show, we're going to be sitting down and talking with someone who's actually outside the faith. But to put it more specifically, someone who was chewed up and spit out from the faith. And I think these kind of conversations are always very important because I think it is wonderful for us to hear different perspectives, to engage with them, dialogue with them, and see that there is light at the end of the tunnel. Especially as you decide to leave toxic Christianity. But before we get to all of that, just a reminder that this broadcast and all past podcasts can be found at snarkyfaith.com and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, YouTube, we're there, we're everywhere. Just look for Snarky Faith. And if you want to interact more with the show, you can find the Snarky Faith page on Facebook. You can drop me a line at stuart@snarkyfaith.com. That's stuart@snarkyfaith.com. And if you want to leave a message that just might end up on the air, you can record it on our website, snarkyfaith.com. So just a bit of a warning that as we enter into our conversation today, for those that have been through church trauma, like myself, raising my hand here, that some of the content that we're going to be talking about could be triggering to. It's going to involve conversion therapy. We're going to be talking about how the church treats the LGBTQ community from the inside. So just wanted to give you a bit of a heads up about that as we descend into this, because I feel that conversations like these are very important for us to have. And with our guest today, he was gracious enough to be able to kind of come to the table with an open heart to be able to discuss all that he's been through. The good, the bad, the trauma, the therapy, the recovery. Because it's just a good reminder for all of us that we are all hopefully moving towards becoming more healthy. That we're all moving towards a place where we're learning to love ourselves and have more compassion for others around us. And these are the types of conversations that are important for us to engage in, to listen to. So that's really what I want you to do this hour, because I know we have some people that are regulars on the show, but we may have some others that are tuning in, and I would just ask that from you for this hour, that you just come in, listen, be open, because I think you're going to hear parts of your story in this story. So let's go ahead. I have the pleasure of sitting here today with George Azar, the author of the new book, My Gay Church Days, a memoir of a closeted evangelical pastor who eventually had enough. So George is a former pastor. Now he's an author and an advocate. George, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Stuart. I'm so happy to be here. Yeah, thank you for your platform and just excited to jump in.
And I just want to tell you that I really appreciated just reading through all of this. This is like, it's an emotional roller coaster to go through your book. But it's a beautiful story that's told in a very just raw, honest, open and authentic way that I feel like it makes it so accessible. And I also think it's an important book right now, especially with the way a lot of states are turning, you know, against LGBTQ youth, trans youth, all this that's happening right now. It's we're in a sad state. And I love being able to have a voice to tell people, hey, you're not crazy out there. Now, tell me so far, like how has been the response so far to your book?
Yeah, no, thank you. It's been very interesting. You know, the people who have read it, same response. And that was kind of the whole heart and soul behind the book, was really just to be authentic. And, you know, for so long I've been hiding myself, you know, especially in evangelical Christianity. It was very much this, I could not expose who I truly am, because if I did, I would not be accepted in this group. I would be ostracized. I'd have to reintegrate into quote unquote normal society. And so it definitely, for me, it's been a process of just being able to hear other people and how they relate to my story. It's so cool because, like, for those who have been reading it, I get, you know, DMs on Instagram and just these, oh my gosh, I had very similar stories. I can't believe, you know, that this happened to somebody else. So, which is very confirming about the whole heart and soul behind putting this piece of work out there. I haven't really gotten many haters, I have in general, but not necessarily to the book in and of itself. Most of it has actually been a very positive response.
I'm so glad to hear that for you. And I think that one of the natures too, that makes it, at least it connected with my story in many ways as well, because I feel like I, growing up around the church, it did teach me self-loathing. It did teach me that, like, I was messed up and there was just whatever was wrong with me and I needed to somehow fit in to change. And I think that's a commonality that will speak to a lot of people, I think, through this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole premise of salvation is you're the introduction of you're a dirty, rotten sinner that needs saving. I mean, that premise in and of itself is dehumanizing, if you will. Then you throw in the element of sexuality and having a you know, sexual proclivity to the same sex. I mean, that in and of itself and the connotations that are associated with that, you know, are so what I call create a psychological dysmorphia, where it's like, you know, I first enter this group, you know, with the premise that I am a dirty, rotten sinner, that I'm beyond, you know, redemption, if you will, but only by the grace of God. But then you have this other element of struggling with your sexuality and being told that it's an abomination, that you are destined for destruction unless, you know, this intervention by a quote unquote all loving God. It's just so, I guess the best word I can think of is just dehumanizing.
No, I think it's a good word to use and it's very applicable to the situation. Now, one thing that what I found interesting about your story is that you weren't raised around evangelical Christianity. So tell us a little bit about, like, your childhood and kind of what led you in that direction.
Yeah, no. So I'm, you know, born to very traditional Middle Eastern parents. My mom was born and raised in the Middle East. It was born and raised in Lebanon, came to the States in her 30s, met my father, ended up getting married. My dad is also Lebanese, but born in the States. And so, you know, him looking for a suitor, if you will, was definitely based off of his cultural upbringing and all of that. So a lot of those practices that both my mom and my dad had, you know, in their upbringing was brought into how they raised me and my siblings. And so I was already introduced to formalities of religion. My mom was Roman Catholic, raised by nuns. And I saw, you know, just kind of, you know, how she interpreted life based off of her worldview and upbringing. It contradicted my view of American culture, being born and raised here in the States. And so I started to form a bond more towards my grandma, who was an Episcopalian, went to the Episcopalian church, you know, in love with Jesus. Like, she had crucifixes and, you know, pictures and holy water everywhere, you know, scattered throughout her entire house. But there was never this judgmental, you know, God. So my introduction to religion was very formal, if you will. Mm-hmm. Went to Sunday school and all of that. And actually, what ended up happening was, you know, when I started to have these homosexual feelings, my brother is also gay. He is older than me. He came out at a younger age, and I saw at least my perception of the division that admission was, you know, between my parents frightened me. And so I knew I had homosexual feelings. And so for me to be able to stick with my parents, and specifically my dad, I had more of an emotional connection with my dad. You know, he was a very emotionally inept, you know, person in general, still is, but, you know, one of the most kindest, most beautiful hearts I know. But the two things that he found most interesting were sports and politics. So I had no interest in sports. So I started getting into politics and, you know, ended up, you know, consuming Republicanism, all of that. But I still had this homosexuality and, you know, politics in and of itself didn't find a cure for it, even though they lambasted the homosexual community. Mm-hmm. So long story short, met a girl at, I was in a freshman in high school, and wildly tortured, just, you know, it was so ridiculous just how brutally my peers treated me, especially in light of my brother being gay. But yeah, I was introduced to evangelical Christianity through a coworker who then took me to church. They had a cure for homosexuality, and the rest is history.
Yes. Yeah, I know. So you were raised, especially during like the 90s, during the Pray the Gay Away years kind of a thing. Entered into that. And so it seemed like through the book, like there was a theme of belonging or seeking a place to belong. And I know a lot of it was eventually you trying to seek to belong in your own skin. But initially it was trying to find a place in the world that you did belong. And church provided that at first, didn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it's so funny you mentioned the 90s. Yeah, the perception of homosexuality was not... the negative connotations of homosexuality was not exclusive to religious circles. In the secular circle, it was thought you could shrink the gay away, and that's largely in part to the, you know, the stigmatization of homosexuality being associated with pedophilia and bestiality, as well as the mental condition of homosexuality. You know, it was just in the 70s that it was declassified as a mental illness. And so a lot of that generation was you know, raised to believe that homosexuality was, you know, a mental condition, where, you know, the church then put it on steroids and said that it was associated with pedophilia and bestiality. And so absolutely, just to belong in society, whether it be with my family or my peers, it was more important to me to disassociate with my sexual identity than to embrace it, because if it wasn't for these groups, if you will, you know, whether it be in the church or in secular culture, I knew that if I was to come out gay, I would be lambasted for it on both ends. And so exactly, like the whole heart and soul behind the faith was just to find a place of belonging and acceptance. Mm. Which was also taught to me in therapy. I mean, I didn't realize the complex until years later after leaving the veil. I was like, oh my God, this is so true. And I have another story about that with documentary, but yeah, well, we could talk about that.
it's great. And did like, it can, in your mind too, when you begin to like enter into this world, because you enter into it as a high schooler, then you go on to study at Bible college or several Bible colleges. You wanted to find a way to fit in and fix yourself. Is that kind of what was pushing behind you? Like, I somehow need to fix myself. God will be happy with me, and this is the way to do it. Is that
100% correct? I mean, I remember the first time that I heard that homosexuality was a sin, and then being introduced to somebody who had been healed from same-sex attraction. And this was, you know, I was in high school, I was attending the college group, and this girl came up and gave a speech about, you know, how she, you know, used to be a lesbian, and now she has a husband, and how she's serving the Lord, and da da da. And it gave me extra momentum to be able to see my sexuality as nothing but an assault on my God, that was curable, that I could just, that I could have these, you know, quote unquote, two natures. It's a very, you know, common word. It's like the old nature is dead, the new one in Christ is, mm-hmm. you know, so, and then just the different analogies and metaphors that were given in church culture about, you know, about these two natures. So it really then solidified for me that, that my sexuality was not who, what my true identity was, that it was actually a result of my, my sinful nature, my old nature. And so, so that in and of itself, then with that understanding, and it ended up creating this, this codependency upon my church family, because what I realized was that if I, you know, was looking at gay porn, or I was, you know, thinking about a man lustfully or all of that, it was my other nature that was doing that. And so if I was entertaining those things, I was not investing in my new nature, which was associated with community and belonging and acceptance, where this old nature was associated with destruction and isolation and complete abomination. And so, yeah, if anything, like this, this desire to belong to a specific community was what drove so much of my self-hatred complex, to the point where, you know, I mean, I was 15 years old when I was told that homosexuality was associated with pedophilia. And I had somebody actually, and bestiality, and I had somebody in the youth group, one of my friends, open up to me about his struggle with bestiality. And for me, it was just so like dumbfounded. I was like, how, like, I have no desire whatsoever. You know, how is my quote unquote sexual sin associated with this sexual sin? But it just still propagated this, this fear of like, well, hey, if I ever accept my homosexuality, then I have to also accept that I potentially am a pedophile or someone who is attracted to animals. And so it's just like, it's just so absolute. And that's actually, I think, the biggest issue that I've really wanted to hone in on, is that, that this stigmatization of homosexuality, it is very alive and well in the evangelical spaces today, about homosexuality being this, you know, a perversion, if you will. And so if anything, having been on that side before and now out of it, like, my biggest goal, at least as of recent, is really to attack the stigmatization of it being associated with these other things that are potentially considered mental illnesses.
And it's interesting for a lot of, you mentioned mental illnesses, but it's amazing that there's so many authors out there that are speaking from places, speaking out of their depths with certainty about mm-hmm. situations of psychology and therapy and things of that nature. I even remember, like, it made me think of, I remember reading a book, this is back in my evangelical days, like when my son was born, so it's like 20 years ago. And I remember we'd gotten a book from, I think it was James Dobson. And it scared the hell out of us. It was like, I was afraid to change his diaper because they make it seem like, oh, if you touch them here or did this, right. it'll make him gay. You right. know, it was all this idea that somehow if you did this, somehow right. it's going to unlock all of this other stuff. And it's such a culture of fear.
Yes.
That's not really based on science or, yeah. or anything yeah. of the nature. It just seems like people have pulled a lot of these things out of their ass.
And
it's destructive as hell.
Absolutely. I mean, classic example, you know, taking it out of, you know, psychology, look at the science realm, if you will. It's like this explanation of, you know, the universe. It's like everything is funneled through this very specific worldview. So if it doesn't fit inside of the context of the Bible, then it's blasphemous. It's wrong. I mean, carbon dating is a perfect one. I was a huge proponent of, defunking carbon dating or debunking carbon dating and all of that. And it's just so funny because it's exactly like, so anything and everything that is put out there, you know, through social studies or anything is funneled through this very narrow lens of the Bible. So they pick and choose what they want to believe in. The associations of you know, homosexuality, I mean, I went through conversion therapy and I remember them saying that that was a result of either me being molested as a child and my brain protected me, or it was because of an over-domineering mother or a passive or absent father. And so all of these things, these are exactly like they are created out of thin air in order to explain something that is much more, you know, complicated, you know, oversimplify something that is much more complicated than you know, these feebly minded claims. And then anything and everything that comes against what they believe in is demonized. You know, it's inspired by the devil. It's, you know, don't listen to secular culture. They're of the world. I mean, exactly. And exactly to your point, it's all fear. All fear. Yeah. No love.
No, you're right about that. And like, even like a lot of your experiences just being on like toxic church staffs, you know, I've been there, done that, you know, I've, mm-hmm. I have done that. And it begins to make you feel, especially when you have people that are of spiritual authority, like that are higher mm-hmm. up in the hierarchy, it makes you feel like, well, maybe I am doing something wrong. Maybe right. This is the critical thinking in my brain. Ooh, maybe that is from the devil type of a right. thing too. So I just need to just be quiet and submit and, mm-hmm. and listen to whoever it is in authority, which only breeds toxicity, especially in the typical yeah. hierarchical systems that we have set up in churches.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the use of the Bible for slavery, for subjecting women to lesser statuses, like all of this. It's just so interesting that, you know, as our species has evolved, It's a lesser evolution of the evangelical or the, you know, Christians in general. I don't mean it like, I don't want to like, because I, two of my best friends are still very much Christian, beautiful people, exemplify, you know, the teachings of Christ. So I don't mean it in disrespect of anybody who's listening that may still identify as a Christian, but Christianity, you know, you look at its origins and, you know, what it was birthed out of. You look at the Roman Empire and how, you know, Constantine paved the way for Christianity to become the empire's dominant religion. And I write about this in the book, and I have my thoughts about that and why that's the case. But ultimately, then you know, if you want to rewind and you go back to the origins of religion in and of itself, the purpose of religion was be able to keep social order. It was, as population started to become more advanced and grew, it was in order to keep people in line, because having a polytheistic or monotheistic deity give the rules on how people should conduct themselves was much more effective than, you know, mere mortals actually, you know, give. So if we look at that, and then we just see about, you know, especially in the New Testament and these orders that Paul gives, I mean, you know, classic examples in First Corinthians, where it talks about, you know, God being the head of man and man being the head of woman, where it's like this whole patriarchal system. It's like, you know, based off of the interpretation of any denomination, you can use those Bible verses to keep people in conformity, to keep them in control. And so anyway, all that to say, well, you know, it's a control mechanism.
Yeah. No, and I want you to speak to this, like, from on two different levels too, because I find it interesting that, well, one, you have been a pastor and you have been on staff. So I feel like I want you to unpack a little bit of those unhealthy trends that happens being on staff, you know, with a church and how they control you. But then on the flip side, what are some of those things that you've seen that the church uses to control and make people conform?
Yeah. So when I, the one specific church that I write about where I was on staff at Bayside Church, the patriarchy was alive and well, to say the least. The senior pastor at the time was very much a zealot for his own personal convictions and pressing them upon the congregation. Now, you know, the congregation was not held to as high of a standard as the leadership, and I came to know that as I started to enter leadership. But yeah, in the sermons, I mean, you would see, like, they would do, you know, either, you know, series, or they would go, you know, word by word in the Bible through a specific book of the Bible. And so many times the teachings were, you know, it almost was like they needed an excuse to talk about a certain conviction that was on their minds. And so it's like, you know, they could pull a random verse out of Romans and then go off on a completely different rabbit hole. But exactly this idea of there being this pecking order that the senior pastor, I mean, the first and foremost belief is that the senior pastor was established by God. They have a direct communication with God on how they're going to lead the flock. So having that understanding as a congregant sitting in the pews or in the chairs and having this understanding that what is coming from the pulpit is actually inspired by God as if it was Bible in and of itself, first then creates the first level of control and deception. As I started to get, you know, higher up in the ranks and then started to serve, I wasn't on leadership, but I was serving, I was doing, then, you know, I would have meetings with the senior pastor and any other pastors, whether I was helping out in the youth group, whatever. And then they would go off the rules and say, you know, you can't have any alcohol, whether it be in the privacy of your home or in public. You know, so it, like, that was one of many rules that were that were laid upon us. But then as I got on staff, I mean, it literally was on steroids. You know, I write about it in the book where I was being monitored on what I was posting on social media, literally posted a Bible verse and within minutes got a phone call from the senior pastor saying, take that down, you know, because it supported the doctrine of Calvinism, you know, and we were of the Arminian, you know, belief system. I mean, it's a steady trickle towards control, you know, but you're willing to do it because it all is an act of obedience ultimately to the God that you serve. So anything and every act of submission that you commit is a direct reflection of your worthiness of to the faith. If that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. And I think that I thought you did a very good job in the book also talking about this kind of a concept of conditional fellowship versus actually having authentic community with people. You know, how churches oftentimes we will have these things. We have like a conditional fellowship. Mm-hmm. So you're good as long as you're doing these things. But real community is a lot more flexible and hopefully loving.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's so funny because like the Christian faith prides itself in you know, God's love and agape love and, you know, love for everybody. But that's just in principle. It's not in practice. It's very much like I remember just even being on staff when somebody literally had a doctrinal difference. It had nothing to do about them questioning their faith or anything like that. But there was a doctrinal difference. And we were conditioned to say, well, hey, wait a second. If this person does not believe in, you know, this doctrine, it almost was like a light switch was turned on or off, where it was like all of a sudden you're no longer in the fold. Therefore, they became a project rather than a person. And so it was very much like, well, how can we condition this person to then come back into conformity with our doctrinal beliefs? I mean, that's, you know, let alone somebody questioning their faith. I mean, that's what happened to me when, you know, when I was talking about posting that Bible verse and then with the Calvinism. I mean, the first strikes against the bow were, you know, this perceived sense that I was a Calvinist, you know, where I was listening to my old pastor who apparently had Calvinist soaked sermons and all of that. I mean, that was the start of it. And whether that was an excuse for them to kind of push me out or it was actually a concern of theirs is not up for, you know, it's up to interpretation. But the whole essence behind that was creating an us versus them, you know, which is such a primal, like it's a primal reaction. I mean, this is what our species did, you know, 300,000 years ago when we first stepped on the scene. It was like, how can we protect the community, the tribe against these others? But as our species starts to grow and evolve, you know, we have less of this, you know, nationalistic, you know, ideal, these nationalistic ideals, so to speak. But the church somehow has still chosen to be in this primal state of us versus them, you know. And it's all cloaked in this belief of, you know, well, this is God's love. You know, we don't want to, you know, taint the flock, so to speak. And it's like, no, you're just choosing not to evolve with us. Like, anyway.
No, I agree with you there. And so through a lot of your journey here, I want you to speak a little bit, and you have already somewhat, but what is that, especially like, it feels like you've been on a journey for learning to love yourself too. Mm-hmm. And I want you to speak about like, what is the power that guilt and shame wield over us?
And
how that's hit you. Yeah.
Yeah. That's literally the, like the strikes at the core of all of this. Yeah, it, you know, when I it was a slow trickle. I left the church, but then got plugged into the church of my youth. And I was there for a couple of years to a few years. And, you know, it was this thing where like, I felt like I still needed to be in community. I still needed to find some sort of acceptance and belonging. And so, you know, connecting to the church of my youth, as radical as it was in my youth, it was less fanatic and radical than it was, than this prior church that I left. But as I started to get more freedom and meeting people that were authentic and real, if you will, like my first roommates were really my first exposure to Christians who were actually tangible and thought about things and joked about things that would have been blasphemous to joke about at the prior church. And it almost became like this like slutty trickle of like being comfortable in who I was and embracing my personality without fear of one of my personality traits being labeled as sinful, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then I started to like, and that kind of gave me the freedom to explore the thoughts about homosexuality in the Bible. I mean, I enrolled in Liberty University. I did this paper on women in the church and whether they can be deacons. And I gave all, I mean, I have literally have enough like Bible college classes to have a master's, possibly a PhD. Like I know the Bible very well still to this day, as much as I've tried to purge my brain from that stuff. But, you know, and so I gave this argument that like, no, women can be deacons of the church. I got a failing grade on that paper because it didn't align with the doctrinal statements of Liberty University. And they gave me similar Bible verses and doctrinal beliefs and all that. And that was kind of like the light switch for me where I was like, this is all BS. Like it's based off of the interpretation of somebody else. So that kind of gave me the freedom to then explore homosexuality. And so anyway, so fast forward to leaving the faith altogether, moving to Los Angeles, being free to be myself. These antiquated belief systems, although I no longer identified with them, still propagated the beliefs that I had about myself. Like that's actually, it wasn't, you know, I left the faith altogether in 2014, 2015. It wasn't until November of 2020 that I started to realize that my desire to belong to a specific group, the ramifications of that were still ingrained in my psyche in the way that I saw myself. So, you know, I still thought of myself as a dirty, rotten sinner, even though I did not identify in any way, shape, or form with the doctrine of salvation in the Christian faith. But because all of this conditioning had taken, you know, quite a bit of time to seep itself, it still was ingrained in my psyche and the way that I viewed myself. So it wasn't until I started doing therapy and energy work and all these different things to be able to see things from a different perspective and actually experience them for myself that it was like this, the grip of control started to lessen as I started to come into myself and be more confident in myself, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. So since then, after you've left and moved on, like what has been part of, or what have been things that have helped you in your journey towards loving yourself, embracing who you are?
Yeah, honestly, it's, you know, first and foremost, it's community. It's finding like-minded people that accept me for who I am versus, you know, who they want me to be. That has been revolutionary. When I first, you know, started coming out, I started to join all these different LGBTQ groups and, you know, met some really good people there, but I met some of one of my best friends there. And so it's like being able to rebuild your own tribe, as scary as it is. It was instrumental in me being able to see a different perspective and embrace myself. And then also just reading literature that I had forsaken. I mean, I remember, again, I've always been a fascinated with the sciences, especially astronomy, like, and everything was always put in the context of, you know, God creating everything and looking up at the stars and knowing that, you know, how crazy deep the heavens are. So, you know, this is God's creation, being able to disassociate from that and embracing the unknown. I think that's what it is, because the fear of the unknown is ultimately what keeps people in control. The more that I let go of that fear of the afterlife and of the unknown, the more I became more comfortable in all of that. And so like, you know, I ended up like, you know, diving into documentaries. There's actually one documentary specifically, it was on the flat earthers, and it's on Netflix. And, you know, I highly, highly recommend it. But I was watching it with one of my friends and we were laughing our asses off. I mean, like 45 minutes into it. I mean, it was just, I was just like, how can people think this way? All that, not taking into consideration that I also was in a, you know, a system of control that thought a certain way. And then like 45 minutes into it, like the moderator of this astronomy group, they were at a bar and he's like, what about those flat earthers? And everybody started laughing and, you know, we were laughing too. But then he started to go into the psychology of it all. Mm-hmm. And he was saying like how these people were devoted to this belief system because, you know, presenting them with facts actually pushed them deeper into it, because the underlying issue was not that their belief system was defunct, it was their loss of community. And that's when a light switch went on for me. And I was like, oh my God, this is what it was. Because there were so many times that I questioned my faith, where I was like, how can, you know, the Noah's story be true? How can Adam and Eve, like all these things, like I had all these doubts. But what ultimately kept me devoted to this group was the sense of belonging and accepting. And so this moderator was talking about that. And then the rest of the documentary was devoted to like the psychology behind all of that and systems of control and cults and all of that, where it's like the fear of reintegrating into secular society is more profound than the fear of staying in a belief system that you no longer identify with. Mm. And so that for me became revolutionary in my thinking. And it was kind of like this, oh, that was me. That was totally me. Like I had so many doubts about my faith and my belief system, but yet the fear of reintegrating into secular society was more powerful than the fear of living a lie.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know for me, going through therapy and having many conversations with other people, and growing up, like for me, I think, yeah, the church taught me how to hate myself and how to look at myself as being terrible. One of the things that took me a lot of work to do was beginning to be able to look back at myself in retrospect and have grace and kindness towards that younger person in my brain. So what if you had advice that you wanted to give your younger self back in there? Maybe it was the younger self that's just being bullied on the bus or after school like you had, or maybe it was your younger self that's trying to seek church to find belonging. I don't know. Is there anything that you, after doing this, because you've done a great job of really just wrapping together a lot rawly of your life. But now you looking back, what would be something that you wished your younger self knew or that you wish you could tell your younger self?
Oh, I love that. Yeah, it's funny because I was introduced to that concept in therapy as well, where it's like, you know, little George, little Stuart, you know, what, you know, not having the tools back then that we have now. It's one of those things that like we were left defenseless in a world that required us to have quite a bit of, you know, armor and ammunition against the people's own insecurities. I think what I would have most love to do is just like look at little George and just be like, look, like you don't need to find acceptance and belonging in anyone else until you find it in yourself, you mm-hmm. know, and being able to, and part of that is accepting your sexuality, like a huge part. I mean, that was the whole motivation behind me, you know, hiding for so long was my sexuality and just being like, look, secular, you know, religious, they have this wrong, you know, as society starts to evolve and grow, eventually this will be accepted and reimagined, if you will. So yeah, I think being able to step back in and just giving him a hug and letting him know that he is loved and beautiful and cherished just the way that he is, that he doesn't need to hide anything about himself, that he is, you know, beautifully and wonderfully made, you know, without the conditions of Christianity. I think that would be the biggest thing. I mean, there were so many insecurities that I felt growing up, you know, to the point where, you know, I destroyed friendships because my alliance with those people were more, you know, it was more detrimental to my survival to stay in allegiance with them than it was, you know, to be strong and fight back. So yeah, I think with the tools that I have now, being able to implement those and just first and foremost, just saying you don't need acceptance from others until you have acceptance of yourself.
And can you speak a little to this? Because I know you mentioned in the book about going to Liberty and being involved with conversion therapy. Because I feel like that there's, I have an ongoing issue with the idea that pastors that have gone through seminary that may have had one class on counseling somehow think that they're counselors now. I mean, it's just out of their depth. And I think that lends into that notion that somehow the pastor is all knowing and he needs to have it all together. But yeah, compare and contrast like what you went through in this weird Christian therapy arena, then towards going to therapy that actually helped.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that. Yeah. It's so funny. Cause like, so I did Liberty Online, and I was there for, I did biblical studies for a year, and it was just so funny. Like just seeing like the contrast between the Bible college that I was at previously to this one, and just like anything and everything was interpreted through the lens of their doctrinal belief systems. And then, after that failing grade, I ended up switching to accounting. I mean, honestly, like across the board, having jumped from my experience is that Liberty University's education was absolute garbage, whether it was secular studies or it was religious studies. And because I say that most of my learning was done on YouTube because I was like, anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. But yeah, as far as with conversion therapy and everything, I mean, it's just baffling to me that I was introduced to conversion therapy through Exodus Ministries. It's the organization in Pray Away, which I have not yet watched, in full transparency. It's too triggering for me. I know a lot of those people, and I'm just like, I'm just not ready to face those demons yet. Which is also an element of healing and therapy. But yeah, so, I was introduced to conversion therapy. There was this supposed therapist from New York who gave a lecture. I wanted to do teletherapy with him. Found out that his fee was absolutely ridiculous. And so I found a conversion therapist specialist. He was a Christian in the area that I lived in. And, he was a cis white male gendered, straight, all of that, like no experience whatsoever with homosexuality other than, whatever conferences and courses he did on conversion therapy. But needless to say, it was a very, very weird season. He was a licensed psychologist, and yet I felt like it was just stupid, so I did that. I forgot how long I did it for. I think I did it for about a year, and then ended up, kind of doing my own healing or whatever. And then I came into introduction with another therapist after leaving the church, but still in the faith. And she was sweet. I mean, she was kind-hearted, but, still under the pretense that I could, pray the gay away and heal from homosexuality and all that. So yeah, my idea of therapy was dismal at best. Like when I moved to Los Angeles and was looking for a therapist, like I tried to stick with celebrity therapists and cognitive behavioral therapy, but their fees were also too much. So I finally, it took me a while to finally lose grip of my connotation of therapy because of my experience in Christianity and it being dismal. Just dumb. But yeah, it's kind of like, I'm a profession as well. I'm a professional as well. So I understand this concept that, if anybody's looking for therapy and you've had a bad experience, it's not that therapy in and of itself is bad. It's just finding a practitioner who fits what your needs are and what your desires are. So when I got introduced to, her name is, Dr. Rachel in the book. Sorry, I almost gave her a real name. It wasn't until I was introduced to her that my perception of therapy evolved and changed. And it was very much like, oh, actually, no, there is something known as good therapy and good advice. And it really is, it's finding somebody who's able to relate with you, who's able to sit there and listen and understand where you're coming from, not judging you or having these preconceived notions about you, putting you in a box. That's what Dr. Rachel did for me. It was very much like, the first time I was going through this like really gnarly breakup, it was the first guy that I really felt intense love feelings for and I thought was the one. And it just ended just, you know, as quickly as it started, it ended. And I was sitting in her office and I was looking at my phone trying to think about, you know, he was talking about his needs and da da da. And she could tell that I was distressed, and she's like, "What's going on, love?" Like, you know, not even knowing who I am, not even, you know. And I explained to her the situation, and she's like, "Well, what do you need?" And I literally looked at her. I was like, "What do you mean? What do I need?" I was like, that concept of need was just so foreign to me. And I was just like, and she's like, "Well, what do you need in this?" And I didn't know. I couldn't explain it. And then I like kind of like, and she's like, "Well, it sounds like you need da da da." And I was like, "Yes, that's what I need. Oh my God." And that kind of like started this journey of like having empathy and love and compassion for myself by having someone modeling that for me. Just like, I guess one more example was, you know, I was considering plastic surgery because I had body dysmorphia issues. And so I was like, I wanted to get liposuction. And I was like, so I sat there with her and I was like, "Look, like, I know that this is so vain and blah, 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 da, da, da." And then I was like, "But I also see it as a way of me having confidence in taking my shirt off." And I was like, "What do you think?" She's like, "Well, what do you think?" And I'm like, I was like, "No, I asked you." And she's like, I was like, "Well, I think it's both of these things, but I can't figure out which one it is." And she's like, "Why can't it be both?" And I was like, and that blew my mind. I was like, "Wait, what? There's no answer to this." It's, you know, she's like, "Yeah, we could have, it could be both things. There's nothing wrong with that." And so anyway, like all these different things in therapy, these different tools that I received where it was like, being raised in black and white, and she perceived this in me, and being able to then see what my shortcomings were and my blind spots, and then to be able to bring in truth by not telling me what I needed, but bringing me to my own conclusion. I mean, it was revolutionary for me. It was nothing like I had experienced before. So all that to say, therapy, it saved me in that regard, and by being introduced to someone who modeled what true healthy therapy looks like.
Oh, it can be like this, yeah, a breath of fresh air, is to say the least. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have somebody else at least listen to what you've been through and go, "Oh yeah, yeah, that was trauma." You're like, "I'm sorry, what?" Yeah, your experience. You know, I had someone tell me, it was like first session, like, your experience working for churches over the years, you have PTSD from that. And I'm like, and she's like, "Nope, you do." And so, yeah. And so being able to go, "Oh, it can be absolutely life-giving and revolutionary with the right tools."
And absolutely.
And one of the things I wanted to ask too is about a lot of the theme in, not the theme, but you have like a thread going through the book about you and your family. And about how in many ways you being part of the evangelical world distanced you from them.
Yeah.
And so talk about how, like, I want, yeah, just a little bit, but you don't have to go too much or too far or as much as you want. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how have you mended things? Because it did seem like there was more of a mending and a loving and a healing part of that, too, towards the end of the book.
Yeah. I mean, specifically with my siblings, it's so funny. My sister and I have always been like two peas in a pod. I absolutely, literally my most favorite person on earth. Like, I absolutely love her. Like, where she saw the pendulum swing so many times, her love was so unconditional. Like, you want to talk about like unconditional love? Like, she constantly was there for me, like helping me, you know, avoid a DUI. And then all of a sudden, to, you know, suffering through dinner with me as I'm preaching the gospel to her. You know, her love was always a constant in my life. And it was so funny, like, when I left the church, the church of control, not necessarily the faith, I became more open. Her and I had a night on the pier in Santa Barbara. We had a bottle of wine. It was like my first taste of wine since being in this form of control. And we, you know, got a nice little buzz on and stuff. And, you know, we call it like we will never forget that night. We were just so raw and honest with each other about, you know, what we had been through, da da da, all that. Then about a couple of weeks later, her and I got into the car together after studying. And she's like, before I could put the keys in the ignition, she's like, "I need to tell you something." And I'm like, "What?" She's like, "We hated you," talking about my brother and me. "We hated you when you were in the church. You were such a judgmental asshole, da da da, all that." And she's like, "But all that to say," she's like, "I've noticed a difference." And it was like, it for me, it was just such a beautiful moment of realizing, like, yeah, like I isolated myself. I remember Bible verses of, you know, Jesus coming to divide family members, brothers against sister, blah, blah, all that stuff. If that was used constantly in the church for why people were feeling ostracized from their parental units, which is then another form of control and manipulation. Mm-hmm. But so there was that. And then there was my brother. My brother is just, you know, he came out earlier. We hated each other just from the get-go. Like, I can't remember any moment where we actually felt love for each other. But it wasn't until the 2016 election, this kind of ropes in my dad as well. It wasn't until the 2016 election that I started to realize, so I came out around 2014, 2015. He saw my coming out and how much easier it was. And I think that there was a bit of frustration there, if you will, but also me not recognizing just the groundwork that he had set for me to make it easier. But yeah, so we ended up having this huge blow up with around my first boyfriend and all of that. And I said, I never want to speak to you again. You've always just hurt me, blah, 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 triggered me. We just always triggered each other. But it wasn't until the 2016 election that I realized that, like, oh my gosh, like my greatest asset in this family unit is my relationship with my brother, because one, we have seen everything growing up, like obviously different perspectives, but we were raised in the same unit, but we also have so much more in common that I'm willing to accept at this point or have even come to acknowledge. And so anyway, so we ended up having this, you know, brothers for the first time moment in Spain for my 30th birthday, December of 2016. And that's where we just hashed it out. And then I recognized that I realized, I was like, you were revolutionary in our family for breaking the mold. And so until I realized that, how he was, you know, really a patriarch, if you will, in the family, like, you know, and especially in this new generation of acceptance and belonging. I mean, there were people in our family that we suspected were gay, but never were out about it. But he was the first person in our family that we know of that actually embraced their homosexuality and was willing to be able to be, you know, demonized for it, for what, you know, whatever that meant in the family unit. And so, and then he recognized too in me that I was different, that I changed, that I was no longer this judgmental asshole. So yeah, it's so beautiful. I mean, they are two of the closest people in my life today. And I wouldn't trade it in for anything. It's just, it's so cool to see like everything come back. You know? Yeah.
No, I love it. I love how you guys, you begin as adversaries in many ways too. And then you end up where you're at. Now, portion of this book, what I've read too, that you're donating a portion of the proceeds of this book to the Trevor Project. I want to speak more into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of my way. I say, consider it a tithe. It's my way of giving back to my community. I mean, I was introduced to the Trevor Project in 2016, shortly after coming out and embracing the LGBTQ community and myself. And I realized that, you know, a lot of the systemic BS, if you will, that kids are raised around is around religion, and especially in the South. I mean, if anything, like if I could envision something for this book, it's doing a book tour through the South to be able to like say, hey, hi, I'm here, I'm queer, I'm not going anywhere. Like, you know, like just to be able to give, you know, because it's such a, they're still stuck in this like 1950s mentality, if you will, in so many respects, but especially in homosexuality. But yeah, so as I started to learn more about the Trevor Project and the work that they're doing and really being the buffer between kids who are demonized and villainized on campus or at home from completely submerging themselves into darkness and committing suicide. I mean, you know, their statistics are profound. Millions of lives have been saved since the creation of this organization because they're able to step in and bring resources to our community that are so desperately needed and yet are not provided in secular culture. And especially if you're in a, you know, not to offend anybody, but in a redder state, a lot of the protections that are afforded to LGBTQ people are not there for more conservative, you know, leaning more Bible Belt states. And so, yeah, so this organization, you know, I've kind of fluctuated between the percentages that I give. My goal is to give at least 25% of the profit from this book. It's been more like 100% lately because I just, I just love this organization so much. You know, I have to be a little bit more responsible as far as my meeting my expense obligations on this. But as long as this organization is continuing to do what I call God's work, I will continue to support. And, you know, again, my goal behind this book is not to make a profit. It really is to be a healing tool within our community. And so whatever that means, whether it means directly through, you know, book sales or indirectly through supporting organizations that are helping save lives, then by all means, like, let's do it.
No, I love that. I love that. I love that you're doing this. Now, George, if people want to find you, if people online want to find you, talk to you, what are those social media channels, et cetera? How do they find you best?
Yeah, so everything is under My Gay Church Days. My website's mygaychurchdays.com. My Twitter and Instagram handle is My Gay Church Days. I'm mostly on Instagram. I absolutely love Instagram. You know, anybody who's listening, you know, if you're questioning or you're in a place of, you know, just wondering about anything, you know, DM me. I'm trying to make my quote unquote brand about, you know, being accessible. DM me on social media on Instagram. I think that's there's an audiobook coming out. It's being distributed. I know that most, I'm waiting for it to hit Audible. It's all, my book's also on Amazon and Amazon Kindle. Those are kind of the main sources.
Awesome. George, well, the book is My Gay Church Days, a memoir of closeted evangelical pastor who eventually had enough, by George Azar. That's Azar. George, I thoroughly enjoyed the book and our talk. I really just enjoyed our time together, getting to know you today too. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Stuart. I really enjoyed it too. This has been absolutely wonderful. You're such a great person. And thank you for what you're doing and using your platform to really advance our species.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that. Much thanks to George for being on the show today. But before I send you off, I just want a reminder for you to share the show, subscribe, and give Snarky Faith a good review over on Apple Podcasts. It helps get out the word to new listeners. And if you want to reach out to me directly, hit me up, Stuart@snarkyfaith.com. That's Stuart@snarkyfaith.com. Thank you all for being a part of this show week after week. I appreciate you all. I appreciate your openness to show up here to be a part of Snarky Faith. And as I release you out into the wild, wide world, I send you out with the holiest amount of grace, peace, and snark. I'm out of here. Catch you guys again next week. Peace be with you. Wait, what are you doing here? You greedy little bastards hanging out after the show looking for extra Christian crazy? What? 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 Yeah, I kid. I love you all. Thanks for hanging around after the podcast. We had a lot going on in the show today, so what I'm going to give you is just the taste of crazy you need. So crazy, it'll make you cringe. That's right, we've got Pastor and Prophet Robin Bullock sharing his deep thoughts, his deep, deep thoughts on how did Noah build that ark. So here you go.
Christian cringe.
No, God, please, no, no!
And you have to ask yourself this, how did he move those timbers around?
Yeah.
How did he pick up those timbers and move them around? Well, there's something called, you know, everything has a frequency.
Yeah.
This AirPod case has a frequency. If you could, because it's made of matter, right. If you could match the frequency of this AirPod case and you knew what it was and you could match it, you could pick it up off the ground without touching it, just through sound. It had to be moved with sound. Well, that's brilliance of mind that we don't possess right now. We see all the technology just actually showed how dumb man has become in comparison to how smart Noah and Adam and all of them were.
How dumb we've become? Oh, Robin, you've just so beautifully, beautifully shown us how dumb you are. That's all for this week, folks. Now, seriously, it's time to go. Get off my back porch. Come on. Seriously. There'll be more next week. All right. Good night.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.